From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
We're Dr. Marla Muzin. She's a grief researcher and retired professor from SDSU specializing in grief counseling. We live in a time when the world is shifting perceptively. Like, that is an excessive use of a word.
Economic dignity has been released in a time of massive upheaval, and it asks us not how we can get back to normal, but rather how we can imagine an economy that works for human beings in a way that hasn't always seemed like a priority or even measurable. Jean Sperling was director of the National Economic Council under both President Obama and President Clinton. He's the author of The Pro-Growth Progressive and What Works in Girls' Education, Evidence for the World's Best Investment. He's founder of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, and he has been a senior economic advisor on multiple presidential campaigns and also a consultant on NBC's The West Wing for four seasons. Jean Sperling, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've had a few authors on the show, and it's been a difficult time to release a book, and it seems like this might be the exception, in that it is landing at a time when many people are paying attention to an accessible economic book like never before. What's your experience been as an author with this release and sort of a craving for information and new ways of thinking about the economy?
Well, look, I'm not going to pretend that any author's dream is to release their book when most bookstores in the country are closed. That said, it is more timely than perhaps I could have imagined. I mean, my goal was more, after being so involved in economic policy and 12 years in the West Wing, was to say that I thought we needed to change our economic discussion, that if you watch the news, you need most discussion. People tune out because they think that the ultimate goal of economics is GDP or the stock market value. And I wanted to remind people that, no, the ultimate economic aspiration for democracy is how it lifts up our people. That's not a fuzzy aspiration. That is the only logical goal, and I wanted to try to define that in an accessible way for citizens, for policy staffers, not just for economists. And so that North Star that I was putting forward was economic dignity. And I didn't want it to just be using the word. I wanted to define that. What does that mean? What to achieve this North Star? And my view was it meant three things. It meant, one, that you have the capacity to not only care for your family, but to be there for life's most meaningful and joyful and even sad moments, that is what caring for family really means. That number two, that's not enough, that you have to have the capacity to pursue potential and purpose and meaning, and you should have second chances to do so as well. And that third, none of that really holds up for dignity unless you have protections to ensure you can work and contribute with respect, and not domination and humiliation. So I wanted that reflection, but yes, this moment is bringing it front and center. You know, Martin Luther King's famous line about all labor as dignity was preceded by the sentence, "Someday our nation will realize that the sanitation worker is as essential as the physician." Well, that day is today. We are being forced to recognize that the farm worker, the home health aide, the nursing assistant, the delivery worker, these are essential jobs in our life. They have value. Right now, we even see them rightly as putting their lives on the line for the rest of us. And so, yes, this moment is forcing us to deal with the dissonance of how can we say we rely on the nursing aide, but we won't give them PPE. half of them couldn't take a day of paid sick leave to care for their families. Some make only $12 an hour. And so we're making some progress in some of the recovery acts, not enough, but there's really two tests. Will we really honor that dignity of work now for the essential workers in this crisis? And long-term, will it change our view of what our compact in our country should be, that everyone who contributes, works, puts their heart and soul on the line should be able to raise their family with dignity, work with dignity, and retire with dignity?
I want to ask you a question and set it up with something that's been happening in South Dakota. And one of the challenges for this state, for our governor, Kristi Noem, has been the stimulus money from the CARES Act that's coming from the federal government does not have the flexibility she would like it to have to handle a loss in state revenue. And some of the language that she has used during press conferences about that has been, I don't want new programs. I don't want to grow government. We've been responsible with our budget. And the question I want to put to you is this idea of, you know, she said these are not conservative principles. And it's the idea of conservative versus liberal or progressive or what have you. Can we have a conversation, Jean, about the economy that gets beyond ideology, about whether this is more government or less government? Is that possible?
Well, you know, in doing this book, what I wanted to do was say, you know, so many people write books and have views that are like, I'm for this amount of free market, I'm for this level of government. I don't think that's how most people necessarily think. They think, I think like I'm trying to speak, they think about, you know, what degree of respect and dignity and wages and security should I have? Does every person deserve? And I think if you start with those end goals, you unify people. There is, I mean, when I talk about a living wage, that's something Adam Smith talked about. That's something Republican President Teddy Roosevelt spoke eloquently about. Those are basic American values. And I do think that if we can have more of that discussion, we will have a more, you know, we'll treat each other with economic dignity. I also think we'll have more practical responses. Like for right now, in terms of if you're a governor, I mean, no governor could possibly have prepared for a 102-year, once in a 102-year pandemic. It's impossible. It's not their fault. Of course, we've shut down the economy. Of course, there's not sales revenue. Of course, there's not income revenue. So it shouldn't be ideological that we don't want to force people to lay off teachers and state troopers and first responders and healthcare workers. So when people say, well, that's big government, small government, that's just common sense. We're going through a pandemic, and we have the economic power to help keep us whole until we get through it. And to not use that because we're having an ideological discussion is really, it's just a shame. And I just hope more and more our country can get by this. And I think Republican and Democratic governors coming back together and say, hey, we all have had our revenue dry up. It's no one's fault. And, you know, please don't make us, you know, fire a generation of teachers because there's an ideological battle going on in Washington.
Right. It goes back to the goal. The goal is not growing or shrinking government. The goal is keeping those government services like teachers and the Department of Labor, which is doing remarkable work right now. And sometimes it's just about how we talk about the questions we ask as journalists and what policy leaders, you know, lead with as well. I want to ask you about, because so much of this book is about how things play out in real people's lives and how that can be difficult to figure out when you just look at the numbers, when you look at growth or when you look at GDP. We're looking at this $700 billion nearly paid out by the federal government for payroll protection plan, but then also nationwide, we're looking at another number which says 14%. More than 14% of Americans are unemployed. Some people are saying if you dig into that, it's closer to 23%, which is Great Depression levels. How are these reconciling in people's real lives that we have so much money that is spent by the federal government to keep people on the payroll, and yet we have so many people who are unemployed? What's happening there?
Well, first of all, let me answer your larger question because it's related. One of the things with metrics is that if I tell you what GDP is, or even if I tell you what your median wage, what your wage average would be over 20 or 30 years, it doesn't actually necessarily speak to the level of economic dignity you've had in your life, because if you had, and this happens often, one period of massive dislocation, whether it was during the financial crisis or now, it's too devastating. Why should people who work hard go through one period, lose their house, lose their health security, lose their capacity to care for their family? So the larger goal for us should be that if we think about economic dignity and people's well-being, we realize it's not just about your yearly or living wage. It's about whether we ensure you don't have devastation when you have job loss, often at no fault of your own. And of course, this is the height of people losing jobs at no fault of their own, a pandemic. And so, you know, the goal should have been to say to small businesses, that was the goal of the PPP, the program you're talking about, was to say, hey, if you're a small business, you've worked hard, you've spent your whole life, you're viable, you haven't done anything wrong, we'll give you money if you've been hurt to keep the lights on and to keep your workers on the payroll. So we don't have this huge high unemployment rate. And it was just terribly administered. Big banks were able to pick their favorite clients over the people who really needed it, who needed it to save jobs. And we're going to have a higher unemployment rate, and we're going to lose jobs forever and small businesses forever. That was totally unnecessary. So, you know, you're right. We're going to have over 20% unemployment. And what our goal should be is to prevent as much of that unemployment as possible until we have treatment and testing and ultimately a cure. But then in the meantime, when people do lose their job, let's make sure they can keep the lights on, they can still provide for their families, they don't lose their homes. And so having, you know, one place we've made progress is we are providing unemployment assistance to gig workers, non-traditional workers. That's a bit of progress in our country. When people lose their job during a pandemic at no fault of their own, you just want to keep them whole until they have a chance to get back to work, which is more of an issue of our health response than it is about their individual effort.
What does history tell us happens next? And I'm specifically wondering, and you kind of address it near the end of your book, actually, but do we see a surge in a call for people sort of demanding, you know, a better economic system? Or do we see, you know, further division and economic despair? What do we know from looking back and looking around the world at what's happening to us now and what might happen in the days ahead?
Well, you know, my hope is that this is this moment of realization, that this is this moment of realizing the, you know, basic dignity and value of all work, and that it does lead to a rethinking of our economic compact. I do see more people saying to themselves, while it never occurred to me that somebody at a hospital caring for me might not be able to take a day off to care for their own family. And so the question is, will we kind of seize that moment and rise to that occasion to build a stronger social compact? And again, I don't think that's a radical type of view. Or, you know, I think the notion that if you are working hard and doing your part, that you have a certain level of dignity in how you raise your family is a deep and widespread American value. And I think that people also start to recognize that as touched as they might be that people are saying, applauding healthcare workers as they go to work, that, you know, Martin Luther King said, what good is it to win the right to sit at an integrated lunch counter if you can't afford to buy your family a meal? I think there'll be a feeling of, thank you for the applause, but I can't support my own family. And, you know, I believe that is not creating something brand new. That's just making us realize where there's a gap between very basic American values and the reality of which tens of millions of people live their lives.
Today, we continue our look at that history with a profile of Marietta M. Bones of Webster. Bones gained national prominence in the movement only to switch sides after infighting within the movement left her disillusioned with the cause and actively working against it. Here to tell us more about the story is Nancy Tysted Koppel. She is director of the South Dakota Historical Society Press in Pierre. Nancy, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back a little bit in the story of Marietta Bones, because I think people might be surprised when she was active in South Dakota, but I want to hear how she got here in the first place. What do we know about her early years?
Well, not as much as I wish we did, is the short answer. She grew up in an abolitionist family in the East and came... married out there and then came divorced and came out here with her second husband, who was a political appointee in the Republican Party in Day County.
How common was it for a woman to be divorced in this time frame?
Not that common. You kind of put your finger on it, but by that time it was becoming more common because the laws were changing. People were looking, women were, lobbying for more lenient divorce laws so that women could bring suit to get out of particularly abusive relationships and that sort of thing. So.
So does her divorce and sort of that process of figuring out what happened in her life next, because I understand, she didn't get a lot of money or support. She got zero, she says.
Yep.
Did that help? Tell us a little bit about how she kind of got interested in this idea of giving women a voice and a vote.
Well, I think a lot of that goes back to the fact that her family was involved in the abolitionist movement. That's the route that a lot of the early women took to come to suffrage, was fighting for freedom for the African-American slaves. So I think that's where it started. And she obviously came from a family of that believed in public service and service to your fellow man. She was always working on one cause or another, and she was very personal with it. I was just reading a little bit before this. For example, she would champion people that were ill. She would take them to Chicago if they couldn't get the care they needed in South Dakota, for example. So she was just very passionate about helping others, and she felt that the vote for women was the way to make a lot of social change. And she was like that. That was not unusual for women of the period. They were looking for social change through votes for women. Mm. I hope I answered your question there.
Yeah. How does she become close to people like Susan B. Anthony, Matilda Gage? What are some of her connections with them? And tell us a little bit about her relationship with Susan B. Anthony at first.
She became connected with these people in particular when she came out here to Dakota Territory in the early 1880s, and she was a part of the National American Woman's Suffrage Association, and she was designated a vice president. She got to know, I think the women became very connected through those movements. They got to know one another. She went to national meetings. She met Susan B. Anthony, I think for the first time, down in Nebraska, at a meeting, a suffrage meeting in the early 80s, down there, 1881. And they just, because there were so few of them working out here, the national suffrages got to know these women because they corresponded. It's now a very lost art, but they wrote copious letters back and forth.
Hmm. Why is it important on the path to statehood? What was the hope at that point that becoming a state in 1889 would be paired with suffrage?
Well, the women had been, promoting votes for women for many years, and the in 1883. Marietta Bones had actually lobbied the state constitutional convention to put a woman suffrage plank in the state constitution. And they didn't do that. They didn't do it in 83, but in 85, they rethought what they were doing and put a plank in that said the people could vote on this issue. There was the idea that you shouldn't just do something without people being able to vote on it. So the problem, of course, was that only males were voters. So it was kind of self-serving in many ways.
What do we know about the changing of her mind or her evolution? Because she comes out vocally and with strong leadership on one side of an issue and ends up to be a pretty fierce opponent of it. Take us through her transition.
Well, I think that often we tend to think that the suffrage movement, I think that view is changing, but I think for many, many years we always thought that all the women were on the same page. They all wanted suffrage. They all worked together with that idea in mind. But in fact, they were individuals just like all the rest of us, and they had differing points of view about how to achieve suffrage. And as you know, it was a long and very painful fight. And so the women had plenty of opportunity to disagree about how to go about it. And for Bones, she was a very opinionated woman, I think would be safe to say. She knew and thought she knew how it should be done. She had lied, she thought, with Susan B. Anthony to get this done. She was a part of the national temperance organization, the WCTU, and she had allied with Frances Willard. And then in 1890, the politics of both the WCTU and the National Woman Suffrage Association, they changed. They decided it was time to try different approaches. And Marietta Bones simply and profoundly disagreed with the change in approach. And it became really personal between her and Susan B. Anthony, because Anthony, who was in charge of the national movement at that time, pretty much said, get lost. We don't need you. Your work is over. And the WCTU, in many ways, Bones went and became a part of the the shadow organization of the, which was called the nonpartisan WCTU, and that went in, that was in opposition to what the people in Webster were wanted and were doing, and so they drummed her out of the local organization, and so suddenly she was without a home. And at that point in time, too, there was a lot of speculation that Anthony was embezzling money and doing different things that were not helping the cause. And so what Marietta Bone says is this just isn't working. This is, neither one of these organizations are making suffrage happen. And until we get better management, I am not going to be a part of these movements.
We live in a time when the world is shifting.
SDPB's The Middle of Everywhere, Connecting Rural South Dakota is an in-depth look at efforts for rural electrification. It's a story that South Dakotans are intimately connected to, particularly in an age where connection, once again, is king. Brian Gevick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much. How are you?
I am doing well, staying connected and staying healthy. How about you?
Good. Oh, at least, yeah, just fine.
Least for today, because that's one of our greatest fears after getting sick or our running out of money seems to be losing our internet service or losing that connectivity.
It's all a matter of proportion, I guess.
Exactly. This is part of an ongoing thing that you're looking on and you're looking into for this Middle of Everywhere project. And the planning for this started long before you realized, maybe any of us realized, how urgent connectivity would become in our current context. Take us back a little bit and tell us about this project and how it got started.
Oh, that's really true. You know, we were looking into rural electrification and speaking with some people about it and realizing that so many people have stories and recollections, and whether it's their personal recollection or in speaking with a parent or grandparent about, you know, when the lights came on. So we started to think about some other things, and in particular how they've changed rural life and most generally for the better. I mean, think about it, the way that our great-great-grandparents communicated, they had the mail, you know, and they went to church, yeah, and they went to meetings and so on. It was very face-to-face. And eventually you had radio, electricity came around. You probably got a telephone, eventually television. And, you know, finally, we were all bound, I think, out in the country to want to have internet service to maintain that connection amongst one another and with the world, of course.
Now, some people will remember, you know, that first party line or their first phone connection. But for so many of us, we also remember the first time we had, you know, our first AOL account or our first, uh-huh, you know, what was the time that you were first connected? But for some people, that connection is still not happening. So tell us a little bit about the new urgency for connectivity and how people are dealing with that, especially in a time when that we're worried about inviting people in our house to set things up.
Sure. Well, you know, anyone who can work at home is being required in many cases to do so. And in my situation, I'm able to do almost everything that I need to do online. My wife is an assistant professor at the University of South Dakota. And back in late March, folks will recall South Dakota State's higher ed faculty were required to begin teaching from home, and we had internet service coming in off of our cell phones, and we just thought, you know, this isn't going to do it for both of us to be on here. The speed was too low, and it was you know, simply too expensive. So we looked into another option, and we were both a little bit leery, you know, about, okay, somebody's going to have to come into our house and get this thing set up. And as it happened, you know, I was working on this project, and I called Mark Bookout. He's the regional director of operations for Vast Broadband, and we were about to become Vast subscribers. And, you know, people living in Southeast South Dakota in particular know the company. Well, we talked about how farms first got connected, you know, being very slow and finally moving up in some places into fiber.
Insofar as evolution of rural internet delivery, I guess it all started out with dial-up internet, Brian. Dial-up internet would provide download speeds up to 56K. And then you had kind of an evolution, if you will, of internet service delivery in rural areas from dial-up to DSL, also known as digital subscriber line services. And when that first rolled out, it was a significant increase in speed, you know, anywhere from 300 kilobits per second download up to 1.5 megs possibly, which was considerably better than the 56K. And then rural service providers began deploying fiber closer to customers' homes and putting equipment that served the customer at the end of that fiber, which just over the years has increased the speed considerably more, leading up to and including fiber to customers' homes, which, you know, you have virtually unlimited speed there if you have the back end network to support it.
Oh, dial up, Brian. Tell the kids how that worked. I'm serious. I mean, yes. The modems and just how, I mean, it went through your actual phone line.
Right. And that was really the only way to get connected. You know, people in town had cable TV, and providers realized, okay, well, we'll provide internet service that way. Well, that's not going to work out in the country. And in speaking with Mark Bookout and others, it became clear that, okay, some people will be able to get a form of wireless internet at this point. Very few people will be able to have fiber come to their home directly to get those incredibly high speeds. And that's kind of where the government has come in the last few years. South Dakota in 2019 dedicated $5 million to help propagate broadband, and those monies were matched by monies from telecommunications companies. They had to provide certain information to the state as to what they would be able to do, and there were a number of projects set up, and those projects were completed, and a very small number of rural homes now do have fiber. Now, in terms of that overall investment, it's a lot more than that $5 million. I think in speaking with a few folks, I was informed that it's up to about 26.5, and it's going to continue, or at least that's the hope. I spoke with Jim Edmond in Pierre. He's the Chief Information Security Officer with the South Dakota Bureau of Information and Telecommunications, and I asked him about the similarities between the current push for rural internet and the push for rural electrification back in the 1930s.
We're going ahead as though the project is going to occur, but we know in the back of our minds, you know, somebody may come up and say, hey, sorry, we need the $5 million elsewhere. But, you know, I think interestingly enough in today's world, I mean, look at the emphasis and the value that broadband has put on, you know, at the consumer level. You know, I mean, it's more important today than ever.
This was something, Brian Gevick, that before the pandemic, you know, I remember hearing Governor Kristi Noem in the State of the State address talking about how important that was and the investment. And what she laid out was this idea that you shouldn't have to choose between participating in the modern contemporary economy, whether that means education, whether that means, you know, online shopping, or whether that means just running a business and having, the smart devices and the connectivity that modern day farmers need, for example. You shouldn't have to choose between that and living in the town that you want to live in, that maybe you grew up in. So talk a little bit more, if you will, about, you know, how some of those connections are being continued now in spite of the times in which we live in, because as that clip just showed us, money's tight, but it's still more important than ever.
Well, there's a very clear realization that private industry really can't do it on their own. And that was the case back in the 1930s, that, there were electric providers, but nobody had the wherewithal to form a co-op out in the country and actually construct everything and get everyone wired. So you've got the Rural Electrification Act back in 1936 that made low-interest loans available, and there were grants, and this is very similar to those times where you've got the federal government chipping in via the USDA, and you've got state chipping in, and the telecoms are matching those funds with very serious investment, and they're really making a determination that it's worthwhile for the health of the state, for the health of the economy, and for the welfare of the people, really, to at least make it possible for them to work with these technologies and to, if possible, continue to do the same kinds of work that they've already done. And as you were mentioning, you know, it's not lost on anyone anymore that farms and ranches are businesses. They need all kinds of information. They need, you know, all kinds of connectivity amongst their neighbors and so on. A few weeks ago, we had a segment about a Facebook group in a rural community out in western South Dakota, and they've really begun to kind of rely on that in some really interesting ways in how they do keep connected.
Yeah, and it's about connecting to your tractor to your to yourself. I mean, it's more than just being connected to information. It's really that Internet of Things as well, and more things that come online, which takes me back to this idea of rural electrification. Really, not there were things that even though people knew that was important in the past, in the 20s and 30s, they could not perhaps have imagined what's happening in our lives today. Can we really even imagine right now what the connectivity that we're, you know, struggling and investing in right now, what that's going to look like 100 years from now or 50 years from now? It's a big wide avenue, well, isn't it, Brian?
I have spoken with folks in the telecom industry, and they see this as a watershed moment. They see that this is a time where we're really going to find out. We're going to learn a lot from this, and we're going to test the limits of what we can do, and that's only going to grow. And obviously, having a lot of bandwidth for our various devices and our various ways of connecting, that's only going to help. I should mention something also about the difficulties and why this is so expensive, just the economics of it. And this is quite simple. You know, if you have 50 people on the same line and they all live a mile apart, or they all live, you know, in the same mile. In other words, you've got an urban or suburban setting. You can run a wire out there and you can connect them, and you have a certain cost. Well, if you're going to run that mile of cable or fiber, it's going to be the same cost. But let's say that you only have one customer. And that is really the heart of the matter. It's just the technology right now requires an expenditure that just isn't cost efficient when you're trying to reach, you know, individual homes that are separated by great distances. And that gets back to, you know, the necessity for the government involvement and the likelihood of cooperative effort on this.
SDPB's Michael Zimney went out with the human creator and the canine star of The Mostly True Adventures of Lupe in order to bring you this Black Hills story. This piece is narrated by SDPB's Lee Strubinger and features the voice of the slowly plodding human Porter, as well as the paw steps of the dog born for adventure.
The bare one there where the forest fire had occurred, that's Storm Mountain. And then that barren one there, kind of it's a little bit of a point to it, that's 5917. And the highest one there that's all forested, that's 6046, which we've always called New Year's Eve Peak, because we went there once on New Year's Eve, and we kind of have made it a tradition to return there every year on or about New Year's Eve, but we completely missed this year because I was sick, so.
What is it, Luke? What is it? You want to keep going? Do you? Oh, you do?
Yeah, okay.
The viewpoint is from the top of Similius Peak. Our expedition leader is an American dingo named Lupe, and the speaker prefers to be known as the slow-plodding human porter, SPHP for short. Welcome to the Mostly True Adventures of Lupe. First, some backstory. Black Hills residents who are avid explorers know far more motorized trails crisscross the forest than designated hiking trails. Sometimes on your 20th or so ascent of Black Elk Peak, you start to wonder what else is out there and how you could get there. Those thoughts can lead you to search engines, which in turn funnel your wonderment towards websites that may answer your question, along with others you may not have asked. And if you query long enough about the Black Hills remote places, especially peaks, you've likely come across the blog called The Mostly True Adventures of Lupe. That's because Adventures is probably the most encyclopedic pictorial diary of Black Hills peak exploration you'll find anywhere online, with descriptive accounts of hundreds of ascents of nearly every named peak, and many that are only numbered. Here's the catch about Adventures, though. Adventures is not a how-to blog. Sure, it's a fine place to find ideas and it would help you get there, but it's not an informational checklist like, say, peakbagger.com, about which more later. Adventures is an ongoing story about a dog, an American dingo named Lupe, who is inimitably driven to explore the wild places, accompanied by her unseen human helper, SPHP, who is equally driven to document Lupe's travels, in posts the length of a long-form essay, accompanied by dozens, sometimes as many as 100 pictures, nearly all featuring Lupe. SPHP is serious about maintaining his anonymity, but has agreed to talk about how the adventures began and where they go from here, here at the summit of Mount Similius.
I've always liked the outdoors. And so I like to just walk. And Lupe loves to roam around. So we just go see what there is. And we write about it. We try to put enough information into where you really wanted to figure out where we went and where we were. You could probably do it with a little looking at the maps on Peak Bagger and that we refer to, and you'd have a pretty good idea where we were.
Although SPHP always loved the outdoors, he says he didn't always have the time to get out much.
I didn't have much time off. It was 7 days a week, most weeks, and often 60, 70, 80 hours a week. So there just wasn't much time to do anything. Finally quit that job. At that point, I'd had 1 week off in the previous 8 years. So I was pretty burnt out on it. And Lupe came along right towards the tail end of that thing.
And though SPHP wasn't sold at first, Lupe would change the trajectory of SPHP's life in ways he hadn't yet imagined.
Lupe's story begins in December of 2010. She was born in Vail, South Dakota, a few miles north of Bear Butte. My spouse one day, who was teaching school up in Newell, came home and said, what would you think about having a dog? And I was like, well, we've got an old cat. We were always cat people. Our family always had cats. I love cats. They're beautiful animals. Very independent and easy to care for. But I'd never had a dog. I was like, you know, a dog's a lot of work, you know. So I gave my spouse a long list of very good reasons why we shouldn't be getting another pet. And I was pretty persuasive, I guess, because I heard nothing more about it until one day, the 11th of February, I believe it was, in 2011, as my spouse went out the door to work, a comment was made, I'm picking up the puppy tonight. So I wasn't entirely thrilled with this whole thing, but Lupe arrived that evening. I was not real happy with the situation. In fact, I was up on the computer upstairs, and I just stayed up there for a couple of hours doing what I was doing. Didn't even come down to see Lupe. And then finally it's like, well, guess I'm gonna have to sometime because the dog is here, right? I went down there, downstairs, and my spouse shows me Lupe, and I knew right away, just by looking at her, this dog is meant for adventure, and we were going to be great buddies.
SPHP was ready for a change, but didn't yet know what form that change would take. It started with a local hike.
She had just turned 13 months old, and I took her up into the Black Hills. We went to the Silver City trailhead of the Deerfield Trail, and which goes up the Rapid Creek Canyon. Very pretty area. And Lupe was just so impressed and so energetic. I thought it was so much fun. I said, well, I'm just going to write a record of all the adventures we do.
For the first couple years, that record was just a private journal on SPHP's computer. Lupe and SPHP were just a man and a dog hiking together in the hills, nothing out of the ordinary. Then they found a mission.
In May of 2014, I ran across a website called peakbagger.com.
Peakbagger aptly describes itself as a resource for summit-focused hikers, climbers, and mountain lovers. It's a good site for details like elevation, latitude and longitude, maps, etc. For storytelling, not so much. For Lupe and SPHP, Peakbagger provided a long list of achievable outings right in their own backyard.
And that got us more focused on climbing to the tops of peaks. We always had done some of that, but once we got into peakbagger.com, it showed us a whole bunch of places we could go to in the Black Hills that we'd never been to before that looked like they might be fun objectives. It's home and just a great area, part of the country where you can, the mountains are so accessible because due to the history of the region with the gold mining rush and all of the gold mining claims led to a lot of private property being in the hills. So there are all kinds of roads and Forest Service roads. And so the hills are very accessible and the climate is warm enough so that you can, even though we're fairly far north, you can go up into the hills most any time of year.
Peakbagger introduced them to a like-minded community. One Peakbagger they met often blogged about her adventures, and that inspired SPHB to take Lupe's adventures online.
I decided, well, I could start a blog for Lupe. And Lupe didn't object, so
there are now hundreds of posts on www.adventuresoflupe.com. 254 from the Black Hills alone.
Lupe has, at the current time, a little over 800 ascents. So we've gotten to where we mostly do the Black Hills peaks during the
fall, winter, and summer, or fall, winter, and spring, I should say. And then in the summer, we head off on Lupe's dingo vacations, going mostly up to Canada and Alaska in the last few years.
The adventures include several categories of posts, the aforementioned Black Hills expeditions and dingo vacations, as well as the Dingo Tales, which documents more ordinary episodes in the life of Lupe. The inclusion of the Dingo Tales demonstrates that more than anything, this is a blog about Lupe. Yes, it's the most thorough exploration of Black Hills peaks you can find online. Still, the mountains play a supporting role. You can visit the adventures to find ideas for expeditions of your own, but it's a different kind of travel blog. It's not highbrow. SPHB might exclaim chili beans when it's cold outside. The narrative often weaves between the third person and italicized dialogues between SPHB and Lupe. Numbers are important. Dates, times, elevations, mile markers, temperatures. Certain names and words become familiar. Their vehicle, a Pontiac G6, is always the G6. Lupe prefers Taste of the Wild brand dog food. Her nicknames include Loop, Loopers, and Loopster, but in the Arctic, she often becomes the most high-exalted dingo of the Arctic sisterhood. In this fairly typical passage, Lupe encounters some elk. The giant deers warily kept their distance. Lupe had a grand time keeping tabs on them as she followed them down the slope. Down, down, down. The giant deers kept retreating. Eagerly, the dingo kept advancing. Meanwhile, SPHB wondered if there actually was a practical way around the west end of the ridge. If the adventures are stylistically simple, they can be epic in length. Posts run as long as 5,000 words.
The blog is a huge time sink. It became a huge time sink. But it's been a lot of fun, too, because I have a record of everywhere we've been. And what we've done, what Lupe's seen.
Despite SPHB's prolific output, the adventures is also an exercise within self-imposed limitations.
It's kind of a strange blog, really, because it's about the adventures that Lupe has, and it's about Lupe primarily. I deliberately did not want to be any big focus of the blog. I wanted it to be about Lupe. Lupe's really the one who has gotten me out. She's a pretty energetic dingo and kind of high strung. She needs to be doing something, not just laying around. And so she's really been the driving force. I've always loved hiking and all that, but Lupe's been the one who's made it really go. And so I wanted it to be about Lupe. So the rule kind of became, I'm not going to appear in the blog. I'm mentioned frequently because I'm always there. And it's a deeply personal thing to me, too, because Lupe's experience is my experience, too. But I just thought it was better for me to be in the background. And it kind of allows the people, my thought, in whoever's reading the blog, anyone who happens to enjoy it, I can be anybody to them, and they could maybe even better picture themselves being with Lupe and doing the same sort of things. So it's just best that I'm in the shadow. So the rule is I'm not going to appear on the blog until maybe when the adventure is over, because there is an end of the trail someday.
It's been mentioned if you're looking for info on a remote place in the Black Hills, you may have run across the adventures. And undoubtedly, there are other ways you could stumble across Lupe and SPHB online. But a deep dive into the adventures would take a serious time commitment to a blog written from the perspective of a dog. Some may wonder who the intended audience is.
The audience is limited. You have to like dogs, obviously. It'd be great to have an interest in the Black Hills, because about half of what we write about is the Black Hills, has been for years. And then we alternate it with all these other distant places on the Dingle vacations. So it's sort of it takes a very special person to have a true interest in Lupe's blog. The people, I get some comments that people enjoy the serenity of it and just being some people like the way I describe the feelings or the sensations that we have as we're going along.
Lupe and SBHP are not mountain climbers. They're not athletes. At most, they do some scrambling. They're not social media stars, but they've amassed an impressive wealth of experience together and compiled a Homeric online record of it all. Perhaps the only real important audience is each other. SBHP's shadow presence within the record makes it hard to picture him, well, at all, but even harder to picture him doing things without Lupe, like the time they climbed Sukupak Mountain in Alaska.
We went and climbed it and got up near the top ridge, which is quite long, and there was a kind of a level area after climbing a steep scree slope where it was kind of, but there were just these huge cliffs very close by, and from there you go up a little ramp to where you can see the actual summit, and it's quite a distance off to the north yet. And I went up to that ramp and started climbing up there. It was something you could just walk, but it became so narrow, and I knew we could not see the huge cliff that was, I knew was just a few feet away. And I'm not particular, I'm scared of heights, I admit it. And for me, not being able to see, and we got up to this little ledge where it looked like you needed to go across this ledge. Was, I don't know, maybe 12 feet long or something like that. It was flat, but it was right next to this precipice and not very wide, a foot or two wide, although it sloped steeply to the other side. So you were really on kind of a little walkway there. And I could not see beyond the edge of that little ledge. There was a drop off, and I didn't know if it was a huge cliff or what was there, and I just kind of freaked out. It's just like, I mean, there's something about being way up there in Alaska. I mean, it was the first time we'd ever been there, and you're all by yourself, me and Lupe. And Lupe wasn't bothered by it, but I just got freaked out. And so I went back down to that flat area, that bigger flat area, which wasn't far away. And we were just going to retreat down the mountain. But Sukupak had been like our main objective for that whole dingo vacation. It was like, oh, it'd be fun to do Sukupak. And we got down to that spot, and I couldn't make myself go down. I couldn't make myself go up, because I knew if we went down, if we started down, we'd never be back. We'd never come back. Lupe would never get Sukupak. So after 10 minutes of hemming and hawing, we went back up and finally stood up at the top and walked across that ledge. And the drop on the other side was like 1 foot. You just step down, like it was a step on a stairway. And from there, I could see a trail going all the way along the long scree slope over towards the summit. And we were so happy, so thrilled. It was just incredible. Lupe was going to make it to the top of Sukupak. It was just amazing. And we got down to that main trail we could see, and it was awesome. It was like 2,000 feet down on this slope that just kind of slopes down to the east and just getting steeper and steeper. But we just followed that trail. Lupe got to the top of Sukupak. It was quite a day.
Is that blind ledge on the saddle of Sukupak a metaphor for SBHP's life before Lupe? It could be. He is, after all, an adaptable character. We know he'd been working nonstop, then he quits his job. Suddenly he has the time and freedom for other pursuits. But maybe he lacks direction or some of the youthful energy of a young Carolina dog. Then Lupe shows up, almost by chance. It's not even his decision. A whole new chapter of his life begins, and eventually it grows into this canine opus with its own segues and subchapters.
I enjoy being on high points and seeing the world, the natural world. You know, just kind of always enjoyed seeing what's over the next ridge. But there is no doubt in my mind that without Lupe, I would never have done a fraction of what I've done. It's just kind of wanting her to succeed, wanting her to be able to get to places. You know, Lupe isn't saying to me, we have to make it to the summit, but I want her to get to the summit. And just because I do, it's just because it's kind of her legacy or something.
In literature and media, we often talk about these world-changing macro paradigm shifts. Many of us suspect that we're living through one of those now. We may be justifiably anxious about what kind of world, what kind of life awaits us on the other side. The Adventures is a tiny, strange little corner of the internet, but in some ways it's a flag planted on a hill, or a few hundred Black Hills, that reps for the dogged pursuit of the personal turning point. Our lives will be altered by powerful, impersonal forces. That's something we can't control. Hopefully, wherever we're headed, there's still a chance for that human-level happenstance that shows up unexpected and changes everything like a feisty American dingo.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.